Welcome to Trauma Informed Parenting. I'm your host, Kathleen Guire. Each week, we dive in and learn about the effects of trauma and navigating neurodiversity. I'm a mother of seven, four through adoption, former National Parent of the Year, author, teacher, and speaker who is obsessed with helping others become trauma-informed. I know what it's like to raise kiddos with a trauma history and neurodiversity. I used to feel as if I were the only one struggling, and because I felt that way, I isolated myself. I don't want you to feel alone in your parenting journey. So grab a cup of coffee and join me for Trauma-Informed Parenting, a coffee break podcast. If you need to talk to your tween about social media safety without having a confrontational conversation, grab your copy of my book, The Case of the Missing Person, A Sarah Craven Mystery. It's a great place to start. This Nancy Drew loving tween and her new friend Mandy are itching to solve a mystery, but when Sarah uses social media to track down her long-lost Colombian friend, she may get herself into more trouble than she can handle. Will she use her wits like Nancy Drew and find her friend? Or will she disappear herself, never to be heard from again? Here's a review from a tween from my review team. I like the book and how it leaves you with cliffhangers. It's interesting and funny. I would definitely recommend this book for anyone who is up for a good mystery. So grab your copy today and listen. Don't forget to grab the free PDF to help you start the conversation about social media safety. You can find the link in the show notes on KathleenGuireAuthor.com. Well, I know that today kids think that owning a device and having social media accounts is a right, not a privilege. It's our job as parents to set limits to make sure our kids are emotionally mature enough to navigate having a device and accounts. Hi, Kathleen Guire here. Welcome to this episode of Trauma Informed Parenting. I'm going to be talking about teaching social media safety with a tween novel. The truth is, lots of damage has been done to kiddos seeking connection, comfort, and encouragement on social media. Everyone wants their child to know the dangers of social media and social media safety, but how do you teach it? Sitting your kids down for a frank discussion about it is one option that I've used for myself, but there is an additional way that you can open up the conversation through a novel. Really? Yep. The Case of the Missing Person. So The Case of the Missing Person is a tween novel I wrote, and I am going to read you the book blurb before I get started on how you can use this novel to talk about social media safety. She finally has a family. Only one thing is missing: the friend who left her behind in the Colombian orphanage. Can Sarah find her? This Nancy Drew loving tween and her new friend Mandy are itching to solve a mystery, but when Sarah uses social media to track down her friend, she may get herself into more trouble than she can handle. Will she use her wits like Nancy Drew and find her friend? Or will she disappear herself, never to be heard from again? The Case of the Missing Person is the first in the series of Sarah Craven Mysteries. It's a page-turner full of mystery, the dangers of social media, and the strength of family. Kathleen introduces endearing, energetic, and sleuth-loving Sarah. You will hang on to the edge of your seat as you root for Sarah and watch the mystery unravel. Now, Even if you don't grab your copy of The Case of the Missing Person, you can use what I'm talking about to talk to your kiddos about social media safety, and you'll see why in a minute. So number one, this one might seem simple, but like if you have even a 6, 7, 8, 9-year-old, 10, 12, and up, ask your child if they know what a bad guy looks like, or whatever terminology you use in your home. Of course, we know that bad guys aren't characterized by looks, but it's a great place to start the conversation. So in my book, The Case of the Missing Person, Sarah believes she can distinguish bad guys through physical characteristics. Where did she get this idea? From Nancy Drew novels. She took a list of traits, might belie a villain, a large or hooked nose, a severe square-jawed face, wild, bushy, or coarse, stiff hair, shifty, dark, piercing, narrow, or penetrating eyes, ill-fitting clothes, a flashy or bold patterned suit, especially loud plaids, and a gaudy necktie. Those are actually from Nancy Drew novels, like the early ones, the first ones. But here's a surprising thing. I'm going to share a story here in a minute, but where does your child get his bad guy characteristics from? You know, in the old westerns, it's like the bad guy wore all black and he rode a black horse. And sometimes we can put certain characteristics in our kids' minds without realizing it. When I worked with SHIELD Task Force, our founder and resident attorney often did presentations on what a sexual abuser looks like. Okay? So on the screen, he would show pictures of men and women, and he asked the audience, now I'm talking about when we were training kids who were old enough or adults, like teachers, counselors, like which one is the good guy and which one is the bad guy? Without fail, and this is the surprising thing, the audience would choose the good-looking, clean-cut guy as the good guy. And the characteristics that I just mentioned in a modern version from the Nancy Drew book, you know those characteristics, might belie a villain, to choose the bad guys. When the adult audience, consisting of teachers, counselors, and other staff, chose the clean-cut guy, then Robert would read off this list of crimes this person had committed. Sexual crimes against children and molestation and all of these sexual offenses of the good-looking, clean-cut guy. So we have to be careful when we are describing to our children what a bad guy looks like. So ask your child that. What does a bad guy look like? Number two, talk to your child about proper social media safety. Now, I know I said, you know, you can just have the discussion or you can use a book and you can watch the character make those bad decisions and then have them recognize the choices that the person is making in the book. Like I said before, I know kids today, they think that owning a device and having social media accounts is a right, not a privilege. It's our job as parents to set limits. And our kids don't have to have something that everybody else has. We need to make sure they're emotionally mature enough to navigate having a device and having accounts. And honestly, after reading some comments on social media on Hot Topics, I don't know if some adults are mature enough, but that's a topic for another time. And I just want to hone in on that. Your kid does not need to have everything that everybody else has. We get so stuck in what the culture is telling us that we have to be well-adjusted and so that we grow up feeling like we had everything. You know what? Any adult you talk to is going to tell you they didn't have everything. There was something missing. It's just normal. And the truth is, when I was growing up, for most of my childhood, we did not have a TV. Well, let me correct that. We had a TV that was not hooked up, and it sat in a closet, and every once in a while, we'd go open the door and look in that closet, try to figure out if we could get it working. But there was a reason for that, because my mother had this theory, hypothesis, I might say, that watching television would turn our brains to mush. So she thought it was better that we didn't have a TV. And what's really funny is now as an adult, I don't get some references that people make to TV shows that they watched as children. But do I feel like I missed out? No. Did I feel like a weirdo sometimes when I was growing up? When people would talk about, well, you know, we watched this last night on TV. And no, I didn't. My TV consumption consisted of stopping at a neighbor's house and visiting her, and she was elderly, and she would fix us a snack, and we would watch old reruns of Gilligan's Island, and they were old then. So my mother made some really large sweeping decisions for our family that other families weren't doing, and guess what? That's okay. You're allowed to do that. You're the parent, okay? You're allowed to do that. All right, number three, moving on here. Assume your child knows nothing. I'm not saying that you think that they're stupid or they're dumb or, you know, the things that kids say. You think, I don't know anything. Well, assume that they know nothing. I have two-year-old grandkids who can log into an iPad, find their favorite show faster than I can. That is not a sign of maturity and intelligence. That's a sign of knowing how the system operates, because as long as they've been alive, those systems and devices have been something that they have been viewing other people operate. That is not emotional intelligence. That is the same as me knowing how to work my vacuum cleaner. In fact, I can still remember my phone number from middle school when I went to the Catholic school. And I could dial it on a rotary phone if you put one in front of me. Was that a sign of intelligence? No, that was a sign of the times. You had to memorize your phone number and you had to know how to use a rotary phone because some people didn't have the modern push button phones. So when it comes to navigating social media platforms, which by the way, I would not let a two-year-old do, I was just using that as an example. Having a session on how to use it is a great plus. So if you have a tween and you've decided that they need a phone or they need a device, an iPad or whatever they have a training session, even if they hum, haw, complain, whine, etc. I cannot tell you how many times when I was younger, when I would tell my mom, like, we need a television. Now, I am not saying don't get a device. That was my mother's decision not to have a television. And I still appreciate it to this day. But I'm not giving out advice on having a device or not having a device. But have a training session. As I said earlier, it's a right, not a privilege. One of the things that I used to do with my kiddos who did have phones was, first of all, I know this is unheard of now in this generation, is they didn't get one until they were 15 or 16, and then they had to turn it in at night when they went to bed at like 10 o'clock. All right, I know, that's crazy. Taking a drink here. So in the book, The Case of the Missing Person, Sarah messages random people on social media in hopes of finding out some information about her friend who left her behind in the Colombian orphanage. 9 out of 10 people said, no, sorry. No, I'm sorry. It's like, I don't know. And then 1 of the 9 said, do your parents know you were messaging strangers? Now, this is from the book. I'm reading part of the book. So, you know, you need to teach social media safety, especially to kiddos who have trauma histories like Sarah. All right? Because they're not going to know how to navigate normal relationships, much less those on social media. Now, in the book, Sarah is, her parents don't know that she's on social media. All right? So that's something to consider. All right. So to the one person, and you might get that one person who says, do your parents know you're messaging strangers? And this is what she says. I told her not to worry because she didn't fit the bad person criteria. She messaged me with a funny face and said, be careful. I received a message from a guy who might have some information. Can you give me some more details about you and Isabella? I knew he was a good guy. In his selfie, he was smiling and handsome. His eyes were bright blue and his teeth straight and white. Those were always good guy markers. I explained to him how Isabella and I were both in an orphanage together. He said he would get back to me. I stashed the Kindle and brought out my mystery board, and I wrote on a post-it note, possible clue from Derek. So back to that first point, like, what does a bad guy look like? Obviously, we know as adults that a lot of times the selfies and the biopics that people use on social media are not actually them sometimes, or they're very edited. So, but kids are not going to, especially kids who are very literal, if they have a bad guy list on a mystery board or in their mind, they're not going to know that. That's why it's such an important question to ask. What does a bad guy look like? And then to teach, to walk through, if you're letting your kid use social media accounts, how to use it. Number 4, set limits and take control. We already know my opinion about kiddos having the right, in air quotes there, to devices. You're the parent. When you set a limit, stick to it. Sometimes I think parents have bought the lie that devices and social media are great babysitters. No judgment here. Sometimes, moms, I know, you just need to have your kid and their iPad so you can get some chores done, get the dishes washed, and I suggest you have them help you wash the dishes, but that's just me. But sometimes you need some time and you're going to let them watch something or play an educational game. So you get some controls to manage your child's devices. And I have some listed in the resources and also in the show notes. I will put the link to my friend Diane Tarantini's website. She is a child safety educator. And she is an amazing educator. She knows a lot more about this sort of stuff, the controls and all of those kind of things, than I do. So I had a conversation with my 5-year-old grandson about controls on his iPad while I was kayaking with him last summer. He's like, so we're in my kayak and he's sitting on the floor of the kayak and asking me to paddle him all around the lake so he can talk to me. And this is what he asked me. He's like, how does my iPad know how old I am? I was like, Mom and Dad plug that in. Well, when will they change it? Because he wanted to play some games that he wasn't allowed to play, like it blocked him. When you're older, well, when can I do the 18 plus stuff? When you're older. What about Dom, his younger brother? Does his iPad know that he's just 2 years old? Yes. How? And so we talked a little bit more about the parental controls that his mom and dad set to keep him safe. So have those conversations and let them just talk. And the thing is, he was asking me some of these questions in a non-confrontational way. He just wanted to know. Meanwhile, my arms are wearing out because, like, do you want to stop? No, go across the lake. go that way, go that way, so he could keep talking. And then the conversation continued with bits of Ghostbuster facts from a game he was playing and how his brother is addicted to Miss Rachel. So you can set limits with timers and parental controls. It's okay to set limits. I remember, and it probably doesn't exist anymore, that I had controls on our family desktop computer and the laptops where it would alert me if anybody would try to, like, it blocked all these sites. It blocked more sites than it should have. Like, sometimes my kids were doing some research and, like, I can't get on this site. And that's okay. Like, well, I'll get on it in my computer and then you can look here while I'm standing here. All right. Moving on. Number 5. Take the spotlight off your child. Because here's the thing. And I've heard this complaint before from my own kiddos. Like, Mom, your generation created all of these things, and now you make us feel guilty like the bad guys for wanting to use what you created. Well, not me personally, but somebody in my generation or the generation before me. You know what I'm talking about. So don't make your child the bad guy for wanting to use a device. Even though you can set the limits, you can set the time, you can teach them social media safety, don't make your child the bad guy. And using a book to teach about safety on social media takes the spotlight off your child. And while some kiddos, like, they're natural conversationalists, like my grandson, Merrick, obviously, like, get in the kayak, he's talking. For the whole hour we're paddling around, he's talking. But others need a springboard to get them started. And a book is a great springboard. When your child reads a book and you talk about the main character, you take the spotlight off your child. Instead of saying, don't message random strangers on social media, you can say, what do you think of Sarah hiding in her room and messaging, like a dog, random strangers on social media and not telling her parents? Like, you can ask. Instead of saying, some people you message on social media aren't who you think they are, to which your tween may respond, Mom, I'm not stupid, or something to that effect, you can ask, do you think that Derek is who he says he is, and Derek is the person who is messaging Sarah back and asking for more information about her being an orphan and her friend, which are cues to go, wait a minute, why do you need to know that I'm an orphan? Why do you need to know where I came from? Why do you need to know anything about me? Do you know who this person is or not? Okay? Number 6, this is the most important one of all of them. Before I start, I'm going to go back, rewind. Number 6, most important, spend time talking to your children and listening to them to fill their emotional tank. This is the last and most important one of my points. Honestly, you can do this one and all the other points that I mentioned to discuss will happen without you bringing them up or with a little poke or nod to, hey, let's talk about this, and your kids will be ready to talk. If you don't do this on a daily basis, if you're not spending time listening to your children talk about their interests, whatever that is, whether that is going on and on about a Ghostbusters game, or a book they're reading, or what happened at school, or what happened on the playground, then it's going to be more difficult to start the conversation. And I get this, because raising 7 kiddos, and there were days was like getting through the, and I homeschooled, so getting through the curriculum, then going to play practice or swim practice or whatever was going on that day. In today's busy world, we often set talking aside or talking for no reason. If all you're saying to your kids are, get your backpack, get your shoes on, do your math, that is not filling their emotional tank. And often, if they feel like they're doing it all wrong, like how many times have I told you to have your shoes by the door? I'm raising my hand here. Done all of these things, please, no judgment. But I'm saying that if you set aside time, if you have to say those things, set aside extra time just for conversation. And if you've never done it before, and if you're like, I'm going to try this one, I'm just going to try and just be sit down. And then all of a sudden the child is silent. You can't get anything out of them. Well, number one, it might be because that child is not a conversationalist. They might need to do something with you, like throw a ball or kick a ball in the backyard. Or like one of my kiddos, she loved to do chores with me. She just absolutely loved it. And by the time she was a teenager, she had taken over the organization of the pantry. So when we got home from the grocery store and we're putting everything on the island, she's like, nobody touched the pantry. I will organize it. But at the same time, from the time she was 4 years old, when she came to be part of our family and she started doing chores with me, she would talk to me the whole time. The whole time. And sometimes it was random things like, I'm going to fix this dish. Or, look at all of these crumbs I swept up. And then it just grew as her conversational ability grew. And then she would want to talk about certain topics or complain about a homework assignment I had assigned. And that's okay. Just let them talk. How many times do we sit down with our spouse? I know that my husband and I do this. It's like, we'll get a cup of coffee really early in the morning and try to sit down and have a conversation. Not because we have something really specific to talk about. Sometimes it's just about work, or for me, it's what I'm writing, what I'm working on. We just want to talk. We want to be heard. We want to be recognized. We want to connect. And that's why it's important to set aside talking for no reason. And like I said, if this is new to you and your child isn't a great conversationalist, then do something with them. Another great thing that I started doing with my kids, my girls especially love to do this, is just to take a walk and talk and just talk about everything, everything and nothing. And that is connection. So that opens up the conversation. When you want to talk about things like social media safety, they're already primed because they know that you listen to them and that they can tell you anything. And even if they balk and be like, oh my gosh, mom, I don't want to talk about that, they're going to listen. Often teenagers will say things like that. Like one of my sons, it was like everything was, that's stupid. In fact, it became like the family joke that he was going to write a book, and he's a great writer, that called It's Stupid. And it was going to be about 2,000 pages long. So we don't often think of it as being essential to sit or move and talk and have a conversation. But the most basic human need is connection. Our kids long to be valued, to be connected to us. If they don't feel connected and valued by us, they will seek it elsewhere. Let that one sink in for a second. If our kids do not feel valued and connected to us, they will seek it elsewhere. And I know that when you are raising kiddos with a trauma history and neurodiversity, sometimes they will talk with superficially engaging conversation about nothing. Or they will have a special interest that they want to talk about. And sometimes that's difficult for us if we don't have the same special interest. So it's important to be careful not to guide the conversation except once in a while, to what you want to talk about, especially if what you want to talk about, and I'm guilty of this. Like I would do this. I go into one of my kids' rooms to have a conversation, just going to talk to you for a while. And then all of a sudden I would see dirty clothes on the floor, half-eaten sandwich under the bed. And my mind is in overdrive, like try to listen, try to have a conversation. But at the same time, I'm noticing all the things. And it's like you have to squelch that desire to make it all the communication that you have with your child all about orders, all about do this and do that. And so if you can, just hold that in and listen. And then at a later time, or if you feel it so strongly, before you leave the room, pick up the dirty clothes or ask them to help you, but not in the middle of the conversation, which I've done before, so no guilt, but don't take a bunch of shame and guilt. But just if that's what you're working on, is that conversation and connection. So just a quick point. Obviously, if you're listening to trauma-informed parenting, you may be raising a kiddo with a trauma history or a neurodiversity, and you may have one yourself. So even if you're like, wait a minute, I do this. I spend hours listening to them and talking to them. Just be aware they are more likely to succumb to the dangers of social media, and not just social media, but anything like in friendships, in communicating with other people outside of the family, with strangers, or things that they are seem to be, I know the word that's used a lot is gullible. I would replace that with trusting. They are more trusting, they're more literal. They may respect a person before that person has earned the respect. And back to number one, what does a bad guy look like? So often it can be like, well, who are you just talking to on the corner over there when you went out for a walk? Well, that's Mr. So-and-so. He's a nice guy. Like, well, how do you know he's a nice guy? And then one of my kiddos would describe what they look like, or that they gave him a cookie, or, you know, and I'm talking about an actual cookie, or, you know, whatever. These kiddos, we have to be extra careful with them. They may listen to the advice or demands of that respected figure. And that doesn't mean that that person earned their respect. It's, honestly, when you are raising kiddos with trauma histories, it feels like they often don't respect us, but they will, with superficially engaging behavior, seem to respect other people for no reason. They may not have healthy boundaries. I'm going to give you an example as I'm finishing up one, and this is a hard one to swallow, but this is a true story. One of my sons came home after youth one night. He was a young teenager, and then he borrowed my computer, my laptop, and he looked up porn because the youth pastor had talked about porn. My son had never looked at porn before that night. But here's the thing. When my son was listening to the sermon, he did not hear the part about the dangers of porn. Executive function block right there. Like, he didn't hear that. He only heard the word porn. So he looked it up. And within a few days, another one of my boys confessed to looking it up because Pastor So-and-so talked about it. And then the second son, he just like was so overwrought with guilt when he saw what it was. He's like, Mom, I didn't know what that, I never even heard that word before. And here's the thing. I know you might be saying your kids, you know, at 13 and 14 didn't know the word porn. Your kids don't need to know that word. They're going to hear it. I mean, obviously they're going to hear it nowadays, but you don't. It's not something that you anticipate. And that's the hard part about it. It's like knowing what to anticipate and what to talk about. And I still feel guilty that we had never really had that conversation yet. I had no idea the youth pastor was going to. So, of course, kids are learning younger and younger and younger, and a lot of kids are looking for answers about intimate relationships and sex at 9, 10, 11. Again, I will refer you to my friend Diane Tarantini's site. She is a body safety instructor. She's been on the podcast. I will link the episodes that she's been on. But one of the things that we learned in SHIELD was we passed out these little cards talking about the bathing suit rule and how in the little card had a little girl in a one-piece and a little boy in just longer swim shorts, you know, like the boys wear, and just talking about where people should be able to touch you. Well, I say don't let them touch you at all. But anyway, some kids are in situations that they just don't know. They don't know. So warning, expect your kiddos with trauma histories and neurodiversity to be more susceptible online and in person. But I'm going to give you a warning right here. Don't make a mountain out of a molehill when they tell you. Talk about it. If they tell you, I looked up porn, or I messaged this guy online, and he's asking me about, are you still an orphan? Who's your family? All these kinds of things. Don't blow it out of proportion, even though you want to. At that moment, let them talk to you first, and then make a game plan of handling it. Okay? Make a game plan. Plan. Don't overreact, but handle it. Because when your kiddos see you overreacting to them, then they often think that they're the ones that are guilty and they feel ashamed. And instead, you need to deal with the person, the perpetrator, the person they message online, setting up some more safety parameters for them. Or if it's a youth pastor who suddenly decides to do this all on porn night, that you go and talk to him, which, by the way, didn't do any good, but it's important to me. So just be aware of that. Set limits on screen time and do whatever fits the personality of that particular child. Dr. Adam Brown, a clinical assistant professor in the Department of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at NYU Grossman School of Medicine, says in an article in USA Today, for those with a trauma history, social media can lead to very serious issues. So, in other words, these kids can be easily triggered by what they're seeing and hearing on social media. And it really worries me the extent to which people may be exposed to things that are triggering them without anyone else around to know or see or help, end quote. And that concerns me too. And that's why we need to be in constant conversation with our kids, like talking to them when it's not about their chores or the dishes or their homework. Just allowing them to have those conversations and connect with us and ask the questions. All right, so I'm going to finish up. Conclusion. Ask your child if they know what a bad guy looks like. Talk to your child about proper social media safety. Assume your child knows nothing. Not about life in general, but just teach them how to use the app if you're going to let them have it on their device. Set limits and take control. Take the spotlight off your child. Talk about other people, either in a book or that they've seen in a movie or listened to a podcast with you. Talk about the other people and let them make judgments there or form opinions there. And the most important is spend time talking to your children and listening to them to fill their emotional tank so that they will come to you so that they will come to you. I know this is a very important subject. And I know that it's also something that we parents practice avoidance behavior in. We sometimes think that just providing our kids with a nice home and food to eat and a bed to sleep in, and they're well cared for, when underneath the surface they have anxiety and depression and trauma or neurodiversity and they're feeling like they don't fit in. These are things that we need to address so that they don't turn to somebody else to fill those needs. Or, like in my son's case, take advice from a very well-respected person in their life and it turns out to backfire on them, but then they're afraid to tell you because you don't talk about those kind of things. Talk about those kind of things. Okay, so finishing up, grab your copy of The Case of the Missing Person today. I promise you, it is a fun and easy read. It's not dark. There are no curse words or graphic scenes. As far as social media safety conversation goes, you can dig in as deep as you want or just read the book and skim the topic. You're the parent. It's up to you. You don't even have to buy the book. But I hope that you will listen to these suggestions that I've talked about in this episode. And then if you do buy the book and you want some extra help, I've created a free PDF to help you start the conversation, and you can find the link to that in the show notes. So thanks for joining me today, and I will see you next week. Bye. Thanks for listening to Trauma-Informed Parenting. Make sure you rate and subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. New episodes are dropping each Wednesday, so brew that coffee, pull up a chair, and let's learn together. If you're looking for some more encouragement as well as resources, hop on over to traumainformedparenting.com.